Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. The latest on shares, markets and investments. Now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the Aurora UK Alpha Investment Trust. We're going to be looking at portfolio construction. We're going to be looking at holdings within the portfolio, and we're going to be looking at their approach to UK equities. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Kartik Kumar, who is the portfolio manager at Aurora UK Alpha. Kartik, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Good morning.
So before we get into it, Kartik, as I say, we're going to be discussing the research process at Aurora UK Alpha. That's something that's going to be particularly interesting for listeners. We're going to be looking at some of your individual holdings as well. But before we start, please could you give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself as well as the Aurora UK Alpha Investment Trust, please.
Sure. I started my career at Artemis Investment Management. I spent approximately 12, 13 years there. I ran a variety of different funds there, including Artemis Alpha, which was a UK-focused equity investment trust. And at the end of last year, Artemis Alpha merged with Aurora. And as part of that merger, I joined Phoenix. Phoenix Asset Management Partners has been in business for approximately 25 years and has been the manager of Aurora since approximately 2016. A thing that's quite important to understand is the home of Aurora is Phoenix. And what we're running there is a concentrated portfolio of UK equities that is run accordingly to the strategy of our research-driven process that's been going for 25 years. And maybe one thing to understand is that we typically run that in a fund structure that wouldn't be conducive to a typical UCITS open-ended vehicle. And that's why an investment structure is actually the only way we could run our strategy in something that would be available to a retail investor, which is why Phoenix adopted the approach of a trust with Aurora initially.
Thank you very much, Kartik. You mentioned there your investment strategy. You mentioned the approach. That's something I'd like to drill down into in a little bit more detail, if we may. You mentioned a really deep research process within the investment strategy. Please, could you share a little bit more details about that and your approach to building the portfolio, please?
Yeah, sure. I think what's important to understand is kind of what the heart of the process is here. And at the heart of the process really is identifying and understanding great companies. So forget whether they're listed or not, because you could be talking about Subway or Mars, or you could be talking about Hermes or Unilever. But the start and the heart of the process is to try and identify and understand what constitutes a great company. Usually that requires some type of moat or barrier that prevents competition from eating your cake. Usually that's coming from some sort of barrier to entry, pricing power. It's usually coming from some understanding of what's leading the human to continually make a decision that leads to one business winning. And it's to effectively then do what we're all doing in equity investing, which is a form of predicting the future, is saying that that's going to be persistent. So what that process involves is trying to gain a deep understanding of the business. So, deep research, I think in some ways is too narrow a articulation of what it is. It's really a sort of deep thinking or understanding of that business. And then what that's combined with is a sort of what I think is typically referred to as value investing, which is trying to handicap that future, not by the way you're trying to forecast it, but by the price that you're buying it at. Because if you can buy something at a very low price relative to the prospects that you think are realistic, then you're effectively insulated from the reality unfolding in a way that you didn't predict. Clearly, if it's more positive, then it's amplified. If it's more negative, then you're protected by the price that you paid. So that's really what's happening on an individual company level. What's maybe slightly different from other strategies is you can almost think that we try and collect those investments in a portfolio rather than having a portfolio that's sort of leading you to those investments. And why do I say that? Is if you look, quite a distinct part of our strategy is the level of concentration we have. So the largest holding that we typically have will be a 15% weight by cost. So that's by the amount of capital you invest at the inception of the idea. But if that stock were to double, it could be a much larger proportion of the portfolio than that. So we're concentrated, and that concentration, which, you know, we could talk about, that there's a theory and a logic behind it. But if you were to try and summarize it, it's really by conviction and an assessment of the downside. So conviction being some sort of expression of how confident you are in your assessment, and downside, i.e. what you really think the outcome is versus the price you paid, the worst case, the realistic worst case scenario. But what's important is when you sort of bring that portfolio together, what we do maintain through limiting the investment in any one company or sector is a degree of diversification against mistakes that you would likely make. So that is to say, to try and maintain a level of diversification at an aggregate level that protects you against mistakes. And also what happens is you then have the risk management that's made on an individual holding that's effectively compounding across the diversification. So if they're uncorrelated, your risk managed on an individual level, but then in aggregate across the portfolio is how I'd characterize both our individual stock selection and then how that's combined into a portfolio.
Thank you. And we're going to pick up on some of those individual stocks a little bit later on in the podcast. But I just want to pick up on the point that you made there about conviction and concentration within the portfolio, because it is actually very interesting to note that on a cost basis, you're happy to go to 15% and then let that ride from there. You know, that I think that really sets you apart from a lot of UK equity investment trusts out there. But one of the things that I noticed that I find really fascinating is the commentary and mentions of investment legends such as Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger across your literature and your website. And it's interesting to note that you speak about the concentration and the conviction of the portfolio and the holdings there. And of course, there, you know, some of the teachings as such from these investment legends. What other lessons do you use from these legends on a day-to-day basis when managing the portfolio?
So I think that's an interesting question, because, say, Warren Buffett writes so well that he's so often quoted. And what I'd like to think we do is, more than anything, look and try to replicate some of the behaviors which those investment legends have effectively led the way in showing their benefits. And so if you look at Warren Buffett, actually, you could look at the principles of value investing, or you could look at the principles of investing in great businesses and why over the long term that yields strong results. But actually, if you look at his behavior, one thing that I think is really interesting is how that company and how he individually is organized in a way to really make sure he thinks clearly. Now, what do I mean by that is, we all know that behavioral biases and psychological factors are really important to have an understanding of when it comes to investing, where the key is the decision that you're making. But one thing is knowing about a bias. Knowing about a bias is insufficient to protect you against it. If you look at a lot of what Warren Buffett's excellence is, it's how that firm has been organized. No bureaucracy, you know, a far distance to financial centers, which maintains clarity of thinking, no reliance on Wall Street, never really had a deal or an idea broke to him. All of that really fosters clarity of thinking, which has clearly, in his case, allowed been an integral feature of the best track record of all time. So if you take that one point, I think that's a sort of philosophy that here at Phoenix we live by. So, you know, we're down a residential road in Barnes. There's one Bloomberg terminal in the building. It's actually not on the same floor as the investment team. So you know, most days here, people aren't looking at the prices the market's offering to them. And we don't typically rely on third-party research, with that quite fundamental idea being that quite often expertise is entangled with opinion, and opinions can create bias, which informs your decision in a way that might not be optimal. But the other really, I think, important point, which distinguishes the way we approach investing to potentially other strategies, is this idea and notion of thinking of a stock like a business. So that's really saying that the core input of your analysis and your thinking is about that business performance. It's not about factors that are influencing the security price. It is fundamentally what is going to lead to better or worse outcomes for that business. And not over quarters, but over multiple years. And I can give you examples about how we apply that, but I think those are the two main ones. Is one, creating an environment to think clearly, and then secondly, thinking about stocks as businesses, because I think it's a Ben Graham saying that investing is its most intelligent when it is its most business-like.
Thank you. It's really interesting to hear that you've got one Bloomberg terminal in the entire building. I think that'll come as a surprise to some listeners, but that actually really plays into the thinking and the philosophy behind the portfolio, as you've just outlined. And we're actually going to speak a little bit more about the research process later on in the podcast. And would just note to listeners that Aurora UK Alpha has a really good reading room. I don't think there's too many trusts out there which actually do this, if any. I haven't seen one in such a prominent pace as it is on the Aurora UK Alpha site. But if you go to their website and look under Insights, there's a reading room there. And certainly recommend reading some of those books. So, Kartik, let's get stuck into the portfolio now, if we may. You know, looking down the list of holdings, the top holdings there, very much UK-centric in the portfolio in terms of the listings, but also very UK-centric in terms of where these companies are investing, you know, heavily UK domestic stocks within the portfolio. What are the big attractions of the UK for you?
Okay, I think there are kind of two elements to that. So first is a bit of a structural point, which is if you think about our process, what we think is really important is observing competitive dynamics as they're unfolding. And the UK is you can think of the UK as a sort of battleground or a petri dish for companies where we can observe who's winning and who's losing potentially better than we can in other areas, in other countries. And part of that's down to understanding cultural factors with consumer behavior habits. And part of that is to do with sector expertise that's been built over a long period of time, as is probably the case in house building. And I should probably say it's not a limiting factor. So if you think about when we invested in Netflix in 2022, that's because the habits that lead to streaming businesses winning share of a consumer's mind and their screen are likely to be taking place in the same way in the UK as they are in the US, Australia, or even Korea for that matter. Or if you were to look at our investment in Burberry in 2024, similarly, the factors that lead to luxury brands winning and persisting over time are really global in nature. So that's really one point, is it's a fertile place for us to be able to watch how things are happening. But the second one is probably a more of an opportunistic point. And I mean, we talked about the greats earlier, but I think a learning from Buffett is that you should be a product of your opportunity set. And so I think that's really what you're saying, you know, when you're referring to the portfolio today, the heavy UK weighting is a function of the opportunity set that's manifested itself there. And you only need to look at the third headline in the FT to understand why that's the case today. With really, we've had years of negativity, probably starting since 2016, that have led to a compounding of pessimism towards UK asset prices. And one of the interesting things there is if you think about it, is when something bad happens, humans value losses more than gains. Is you try and protect yourself from something bad happening again, so you probably revise your expectations down. And if a series of bad things happen, you continue to do that to protect yourself because you don't like negative surprises. But what that happens is you might have quite a warped view of what the real long-term reality is. And in the case of the UK, particularly if you're talking about the domestic market here, so really the FTSE 250 and the companies that populate that, is in our judgment, you have a situation where effectively environment's led to a scenario where businesses are trading in the market at a price where your future returns are probably going to be actually a lot better than business returns. So if we can identify what we think are the great companies within that, from this point on, our investment returns are really should be quite compelling. And you know, we can go into various examples. I think Frasers is a very poignant example, partly because we've held it since 2007 and understand it, but it is a UK focused retailer with all of what comes with that.
Yes, I mean, let's pick up on Frasers Group there, and maybe if Kartik, you could frame the investment process around Frasers Group and really provide listeners an explanation of your research process, because of course, as you said, you've only got one Bloomberg terminal in the building, so you're not sitting there watching prices go backwards and forwards. So that would suggest that, you know, the research comes from a little bit more of a hands-on approach, really. So, you know, if you could explain to listeners your research process and what went in to Fraser's Group, you know, maybe the length of time, what you actually went out and did in as part of your research for Fraser's to actually earn itself as a place as the biggest holding within the portfolio.
Sure. I'll actually just start with a different observation, which is the value in not watching whether Fraser's is £6.58 or £7.10 today is when you really think about these periods of under or overvaluation, how a price is tracking relative to what you perceive the fundamentals of the business are. They happen over sort of, you know, I think in our judgment, there was a 5-year period in which Fraser's was trading well below what our judgment was of intrinsic value. This is from 2008 to 2013. And you know, I think we started our holding at £1.50, the stock troughed at 50p. And then over 18 months, it went to £6. But so we've held Fraser's through various points. The more important point is if you're not looking at the price and you're trying to work out what the value of the business is, you might be asking different questions. How are AI agents going to impact how consumers buy products? Is that going to impact Fraser's in a way that's going to change the next 5-10 years? Is Shein in the UK, the Chinese retailer, is that going to take market share from Fraser's, or is that an issue for Primark? It's more about the sort of focus on what's really going to dictate your long-term investment returns that might be derived from hands-on research, which we can talk about, such as, you know, going to the stores. In 2014, one of the reasons we significantly reduced our holding at £7-8 a share was because some of the team had gone to Eastern Europe to see how Fraser's were, then Sports Direct, expanding in Eastern Europe and wasn't happy with the store standards. Or didn't think that the offering was resonating in the same way that it was in the UK, where they were highly dominant. So that's not answering the question specifically, but it's just pointing out that point about not being focused on the price. One of the most important things is about what you're focused on and then how you inform your judgment about that. You know, feet on the street research is one way of doing it, but even just making sure your focus is in the right areas, I think is quite an important point. To your question about Fraser's, I could speak for probably half an hour on this point alone, because we've held it since 2008 and it's had a long, rich history. So we've been continuous holders since 2008, but really in significant size since again in 2016, after the stock price fell from £8 to £1.80. Maybe it'd be most helpful for me to just frame why we think it's a good manifestation of the undervaluation in the UK is, you know, in Fraser's, you have a business which on any metric has been a tremendously successful retailer. So if you look at Mike Ashley, I mean, he owns 70% of the company. He started with, you know, having been a squash teacher and just all his own money. He's never raised any external money. And today he's got 70% of a £3 billion company that we think is worth more like £8 billion, right? So if you just work out what he's compounded on his internal capital since he started Fraser's or then Sports Direct, you clearly have a huge success story that's worth understanding. And maybe just one point that I think is quite often people wince at the idea of investing in retail. Retail is risky. And that's really right, because the failure rate in retail is high. And if you look in the UK in the last 5-10 years, there's been a bloodbath. There's the internet. Look at how that destroyed Debenhams. I still remember looking at when that was listed and seeing that they were pricing Fitbits at £150 when you could buy them on Amazon for 100. You're never going to have a sustainable business that way. But also, I think it's worth just bearing in mind this the extraordinary value creation that can happen in retail when it works. So look at Walmart in the US. I think the Walton family, singly the largest amount of value creation for one family, possibly at least in the last 100 years. If you bought the Nifty 50 and you just continued holding Walmart, you would have outperformed the index as long as you hadn't sold your Walmart position. So retail, I think, can be mischaracterized. But what's really important is there is a high failure rate, but if you can stay on top of what's working and why, fundamentally, because you lease your stores, because you're paid before by your customers before you pay your suppliers, when you're expanding, it's a tremendously successful model of which the UK has done really well at manifesting multiple examples. You know, 3i is the best performing stock in the UK over, I think, 5 and 10 years. And that's because of its Eastern European, primarily Eastern European, now pan-European discount retailer action. But even, you know, even in the private segment, look at Home Bargain. So that's why retail can be interesting. If you look at Frasers, it's a business today that's valued at 3 billion. It owns over £1 billion of freehold property. It generates nearly 400 million, depending on how you look at it, of free cash flow a year in what we think is a really impressively run business with a entrenched position in UK sports. Amazon have tried to come in, Decathlon have tried to come in. And yet, if you ask anyone, where are you going to buy your son's football shoes in September? They've only really got one option, which is Sports Direct. So there are a variety of factors that have led to the success. And we've studied that all, you know, for years here at Phoenix. We used to run a price survey that looked at where Sports Direct was priced versus all other retailers. And that ranged from football boots to trainers to tennis rackets. And what you could see was a business that was competitively priced and earning a 20% return on invested capital. And what's really impressive today is it's evolved into a much, much bigger business that has a position in luxury retail, in its flannels business, has a number of own brands, which are very interesting. So if you look at Everlast, lots of things have changed in boxing, but one thing hasn't, which is the most dominant brand is Everlast. That's fully owned by Frasers. So why I think it's a very interesting one to look at is it's noisy. When it buys a failing retailer, often that doesn't work in quite the right way. It doesn't always work for them. But if you look at what it's done over time, is it's been tremendously successful at taking advantage of the change that's been happening in the retail industry. And it's really gone from strength to strength. And, you know, yet here we are today, 15 years later from 2010, which is the last period in which it was very undervalued. It's just a much larger business, but in our judgment, the discount to intrinsic value is really very high because of some of the headwinds, both to the consumer that are well known, but also to, I guess, an aversion to retailing businesses.
Thank you. I was going to ask, Kartik, where you see the moat and why you see it as an £8 billion company as opposed to a £3 billion company. But you've just answered that question very comprehensively. Thank you. Thank you very much. So let's now move on to another holding within the portfolio, which I find particularly fascinating. Barratt Redrow, your second largest holding, but it's the only house builder within the top 10 that I can see here. What makes Barratt Redrow so attractive compared to the rest of the peer group?
So we do have a position in another house builder. And maybe one thing to point out is we find the sector very attractive. So it's a kind of, if you think, why house building at a first level? There are a couple of points here that I think people aren't putting a very high value on today. And that's because there's a lot of change that's exciting, particularly around AI. But if you think when you're investing and you've got a long-term horizon, there's quite a high value in things that don't change. And if you think housing is a really essential need, if you think about something like AI, how is that going to change the need for housing? It's probably not. How is it going to change the way it's served up? It's not. The business model isn't changing for the construction companies. And that's actually a very valuable feature in itself that at times like this, and you saw it in 99, those business models are less attractive in the eyes of the market because they're not expanding in the same way that this new technological shift is doing for other industries. So that's one point, and you know that would apply to say an investment we have in something like Dignity, where it's funerals. It's predictable, growing essential need. But I mean, housing. I mean, it's such a topical factor in the UK right now. Topic. What you do know, and you can look at it through a variety of different lenses, is that it's really underserved, right? And you can either look at that from the various reports that have been put into it, or you can just do a very simple look at the rise in rents. You know, so housing is an essential need. If you can't buy it, two things happen. You either stay at home for longer. And you've seen that household formation in the UK has been constrained relative to other countries. Or if you can't buy a house, you rent it. And the excess demand for housing is in the last 2 years manifested itself in higher rents. If you look at a company level, and you asked about moats, is what's interesting about house building is the moat doesn't look that obvious. You kind of think, well, if we raise some money, couldn't we buy some land, build some houses and sell it? But if it was so easy, you'd find a lot more entrants. The reality is there has not been a new national house builder in the UK since the 1970s. And that's because it's actually intrinsically very hard to do well and very hard to scale. And I could give you some detail of that. But even if you look at what the CMA did when they investigated the sector, the CMA concluded that it wasn't worth regulating the sector, that it did earn very high returns on capital, so that they're in excess of 15%. And that the reason that they earned high returns and that regulation wouldn't work is because it was due to the complications of the planning system. So if you regulated the sector, all you'd do is end up constraining housing output, which is not really in anyone's benefit. So that's kind of an explanation of why we think the sector is attractive in aggregate. Why concentrate your efforts and your invested capital on Barratt is really a bit more of a nuanced point. And that is because if you accept that house building, if you were to look at the business of house building, is actually quite hard. You've got to buy the land at the right price. That means making assumptions about the future. You've got to build the house without errors. You've got to try and sell it quickly. And then you've got to do it again. So you've got to start buying more land. And if you look either at small house builders, you can see how problematic this can be. You know, you get the foundations wrong. That's pretty hard to rectify. You find a Roman ruin in part of your plot, and that's not great. Or you're planning, you buy something without full planning and you find that you're waiting 3 years for it to be approved. Well, that wouldn't be great if that was your only site. So house building is hard. So what you want is you want a really large operator where you might not see that Roman ruin turn up when you're operating at 300 sites, which is Barratt. So you want scale. Clearly, the large builders all have scale. And so really why we like Barratt as a company is being invested in it over 25 years from visiting their sites, from knowing the management teams, from having spent days with their land buying teams, is an understanding and really a confidence in it being operationally excellent. And that's in everything from how it buys land, how that process works, how they are operating on site, how they're treating customers, suppliers. So it's really all of that is that we just think it's the lowest risk and best operationally performing way of expressing that view on UK house building.
Thank you. The explanation there about the difficulties of scalability were particularly interesting. So thank you very much for those, Kartik. We'd like to move on now to, again, another position with the portfolio, which you have touched on, but let's go into a bit more detail here. It's Dignity. Phoenix took the unusual step in leading a takeover of the company. It's, of course, one of the UK's leading funeral services. What was the thinking behind that and how's it going at the moment?
Yeah, so I think I touched on it in the house building point is if you think about it from a market level, there are reasons for why the end of life industry in aggregate, and I'll explain why I say end of life rather than funerals, is attractive. So I'll take that as understood. But if you look at Dignity, Dignity is a really interesting company within that sector because it operates at need. So this is a funeral when you need it, branches. So you see those all over the country under the various branches. There are 560 of those branches. It's only second to the co-op. It has 46 crematoria. So the crematoria are a pretty scarce asset. They're very hard to build because of planning. There are about 350 of them across the UK. 80% of people, when they pass away, are cremated rather than buried. So it owns those critical infrastructure assets. And then it owns a really interesting business, which is a pre-need. So this is buying funerals in advance of you needing them business, which it is able to service through its branches and crematoria. And there, it approximately has nearly £1 billion of assets, which are the prepayments for that business. And if you think, why is that a really interesting business? Is a bit like Warren Buffett's Geico, is its float. So you can earn a return on those assets. The customer gets in our opinion, a good value proposition because when the purchase is made, it is not distressed and it can be at a better value than buying an at-need funeral. But from your business perspective is you're securing future market share and you are able to earn the returns on that float. So it's really a very interesting business model. And what happened was Dignity went through a period of time where it was effectively just very poorly managed. In this type of industry, you can put up prices and lose market share as the company did without it effectively being totally destructive to the business. It's like atrophy. You're slowly wasting away because you are treating your customers poorly. But effectively, that is what Dignity did until 2018, when both because of really competitive reasons and the CMA, they had to significantly cut prices. And as a result of that, the share price fell from £28 a share to probably a trough of £8 and then down to £3 in COVID. And Phoenix built up a 30% holding in that time and then made an offer for it at at £5 a share in 2023. And the reason really for that was really correcting some of these cultural and operational issues would be best done with control and possibly be best done outside of the public markets. But really, if you look at it, what's so attractive is the UK death rate is set demographically. It's a function of what happened approximately 83 years ago, which was births then, and it's set to grow steadily by about 1% per annum. And what we think is if you have a business that really puts an emphasis on treating customers well, delivered through the inherent advantages of this vertically integrated business, you can be a leader in the end of life industry, which from an economic standpoint would be a tremendously attractive business. And so we're approximately 2.5 years into that journey. We've changed the management team. So the previous CEO of Future, called Zillah Thorne, is the CEO of Dignity. And we're really encouraged by some of the changes that we're seeing in turning around that business. So it's a pretty unique company. It's a unique holding for us because we own the company privately, although it's listed in Carcinome, which is an investment trust that we control. You know, we think it'll be one of our most attractive investments.
That's a really interesting point that you make there, because, you know, going back to the approach that Aurora takes and why it's suited to an investment trust, a closed-ended structure as opposed to an open-ended structure, the reason being is holdings like this. But, you know, when you're holding a position like Dignity that is privately held, what's the plan for it over the longer term, Kartik? Is it something to grow within the portfolio and take dividends from? Was it something you'd then eventually look for an exit for?
So just to be clear, is Carcinome took Dignity private. Carcinome is listed and Aurora is a shareholder in Carcinome, and Carcinome is managed by us, Phoenix. So it does have a listing, even though Dignity is a private company within Carcinome. We do anticipate some sort of liquidity event, either through a relisting or through a dividend recap that you pay back the cash that the company is generating. So it is our anticipation to have a liquidity event for it. Quite what the form would be, we're not certain of now. We'll do what's best for the business and shareholders.
Thank you. That's certainly going to be a story that's worth keeping an eye on. So I want to now look at, you know, activity within the portfolio. It's always something that I like to speak about to get a flavour for, you know, where you're seeing value at the moment and where you're allocating capital. One of the things that I note, which is very interesting, is Aurora say you tend to have a propensity to do nothing. You know, of course, that doesn't mean research. Of course, you're out researching. That would refer to changes within the portfolio. But if we look back to April of this year and the severe volatility that we saw in markets, we saw really sharp drawdowns in particular stocks. Was that a time that you put any of your research to work and went out and bought anything in the markets?
Yes, and to be specific, so we kind of say that we're like a duck on a lake, you know, calm on the surface, but always pedaling under the water frantically. And you know, that's the work. And then we will act when the market gives us an attractive opportunity, which is exactly what we thought happened in April, when you have a sort of systematic event where prices indiscriminately are falling. That's really when you would expect us to be active. So there we sort of did two things. One is that we started building up a holding in Burberry last year. We were paying £6.50 a share. Then a rumor came out about a potential takeover, and the stock actually went up to about £11 a share. And then back around tariffs, it came back to our initial entry price of £6.50 to under £7 a share. So that was a key addition that we made there. We've been adding to Barrett through the year, which has weakened in price considerably, partly because of, I think, perceptions about the macro environment, and then also difficulties it's had with its outlet growth. There have also been additional cladding remediation liabilities put on the firm, all of which we don't think has a material impact on intrinsic value. And even if it does, the price has fallen significantly in excess of any marginal impact to value. So those are the two primary changes that we've made. We've also started a new holding in an overseas stock. We have a policy to not disclose stocks until they reach 3%. So I can't actually mention what that one is right now.
Thank you. Really interesting, Kartik. So to wrap things up now, really comprehensive conversation. Thank you very much for your insights today. For listeners that are considering the trust, what would you say are the main reasons that they should consider adding Aurora UK Alpha to their portfolio?
So just on, you know, on the process, I think we're differentiated, and I think we have a clear edge. I think I've already talked about that, but we run a concentrated portfolio that's long-term and research-driven. It's the same process for 25 years. We've got a rigorous focus on the downside, and we'll communicate to you transparently. So if you value patients, alignment and depth of research, I think Aurora is kind of built for you. But there's some shorter-term factors that I think are interesting. So we measure intrinsic value on our holdings, and we have done in a reasonably consistent way for over 20 years. And then we can aggregate that up at a portfolio level and look at what the price to intrinsic value is on a portfolio level. And today we estimate there's 140% upside to intrinsic value. And we can even do things like backtest and say, historically, when the portfolio was this cheap, what did future returns look like? And so as an indication at this sort of level, 3-year returns have been in the high teens percentage per annum. And we've rarely had a negative quarter actually at this level of cheapness. And more recently, there's been a discount in our trust emerge, which actually means that if you think about from the price you pay for the trust, the discount to intrinsic value is more like 160%. So in my mind, that is the first point was kind of like why I think we will appeal to investors who share our philosophy. And the second one's kind of why I think now is an attractive point. And there's one last point which I think may not be fully appreciated is I think our fee structure is differentiated. So we don't charge any management fees, and we only charge a fee on performance, which is only crystallized if that performance is sustained over a 3-year basis. And so what it really means is if we don't outperform the index, we will work for free. And it also means that I think it creates a very high degree of alignment with our investors.
It does. It does indeed. Not many trusts do that. And that's a really big vote of confidence in your processes that we've discussed today. So just as a note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to the Aurora page in the UK Investor Magazine Investment Trust Centre. You'll be able to look at the latest literature. And get a really good insight in some of the points that Kartik has kindly made today. I did say that was the last question, but I do have one final one here, Kartik. We spoke about the reading room, which is accessible through your website. What are your favourite books that are within that reading room?
Maybe I'll talk about one that I think is in there and then one that isn't yet. There's a book about investing. In the reading room, we actually have businesses and we have books on businesses, biographies, behavioral psychology, and investing. But there's a book called What I Learned from Darwin About Investing, which I think is very thought-provoking. It's by an investor in Indian equities called Pulak Prasad. And why I like it is because I think it firstly has some very interesting points about just evolutionary theory. Done in a way that I think when it's related to businesses really makes you think about investing outcomes over time and process and approach. I'd characterize that approach as probably if in the market sense is very quality biased, but I think it's really very thought-provoking and under-recommended from what I can see as a book about investing. And then maybe the second one would be The Hour Between Dog and Wolf, which is actually just one I'm rereading at the moment, but I kind of almost think is a must reread every couple of years, which is a book that really analyzes physical impulses and reactions, even things like hormonal triggers in the context of financial markets. Why I think that it is, firstly, I think intellectually very rigorous in terms of what it does. There's a passage in there about, how your gut has its own stomach, and you can almost just see your stomach is technically outside of your body. It's actually, your mouth is a hole and it's actually your body's around it. But why I think it's so fantastic is because it can really make you think about better recognizing what emotions you're experiencing, be it when you see a red price and you've made a mistake and a stock is down, what is it that your body is doing and that you are actually doing subconsciously, which is a function of evolution. In that case, it's a stress reaction. Your cortisol level is elevated. And then similarly, what happens in a bull market when you've got three things right, things have gone your way, and how your body is actually leading you to do things that are then quite likely to impact your mind and thinking. So I think it's quite an old book, whereas What I Learned from Darwin's a new book. But I think those are two really fantastic ones.
Certainly, I think the psychology of investing is particularly fascinating. So that sounds like a book that most readers should have a look at and check out. So thank you very much for those, Kartik. And thank you very much for being with us today.
Great. Well, thank you for your time and thank you for having me on.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.